This is your final warning. The second annual Heritage Radio Network Holiday Gala and Auction is this Monday, December 3rd, 2018. You can get tickets and more information at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. I will be there. Other Heritage hosts will be there. There will be incredible food and drink, and there will be auction items that you will want to be bidding on. I hope to see you there. Again, heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
At Geist, I sort of, as in life, firmly believe that the truth is easier to remember than the lie. And by that, I mean no secrets. By that, I mean an open kitchen. Mm-hmm. Open, no shelves. Everyone can see each other. You're completely naked. And there's something beautiful about when you, as a chef, can actually see who you're cooking for. But there's also some beauty in the people that are eating. Can see who is cooking for them. But the thing is, eventually, there'll be pressure points. And when those pressure points are there, there can be a moment where you're under such a tremendous pressure that you are, in a way, getting slaughtered. Mm-hmm. You're dying, not physically dying, but you're under so much, you have so many balls in the air. And there I have an expression called, you have to die beautiful. Don't do the movements of you're under pressure when you talk to someone by pointing. Like, do the act, be with it, yeah. and perform.
That is Chef Bo Beck of the Copenhagen restaurant Geist and author of the new book, In My Blood. Today's guest on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am flying solo this morning. It is a Saturday morning, December 1st. We are now well into the holiday season, and things have just exploded at the Friedman household. Caitlin is out and about doing some stuff, and we're doing two shows a week right now, so you've got me all to yourselves. Our guest today is Chef Bo Beck. Bo is someone I'd probably describe as a chef's chef. A lot of chefs really look up to and admire him. It's quite something because he didn't even start cooking professionally until he was 24, which we get into at the very end of the interview. So I hope you will listen to this all the way through because it's really something to hear him talk about it. But Bo used to be at the restaurant Paustian. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And for the last 7+ years, he's been at, I guess what you would call a more casual restaurant. I have not been there myself. It's called Geist. It is very popular. It is deliberately not a formal, stuffy restaurant. It's much more of, I guess, what you'd call an everyday place that people go to. And it's extremely popular. And Bo has authored a new book, and the book is called In My Blood, and it is a stunner. And I want to say, if you've been following the show chronologically, we just had Magnus Nilsson on the show this week. I usually treat these shows the way I think a disc jockey treats a mix, and I try to really vary, I guess what you would call the profiles and the geography and the gender of the guests from episode to episode. So it may seem odd that I have two guys from Europe on back to back, two people who have books just out back to back, but A, sometimes it makes sense to as with a good DJ, to have a second song or a song that follows the song that emphasizes certain things about the first one but isn't identical to it. And that's kind of how I felt this week. I think this is actually a great follow-on to the interview with Magnus. And also, because it is the holiday season, I wanted to get this show up as soon as possible as a tribute to Chef Bo Beck, because I think you might want to buy this for people. If you do, I'm going to mention up top, the website that Bo has is chefbobeck.com. That's Chef Bo Beck, BOBECH.com. I'm told that they generally get the book to people within 5 days. That's the best place to go do that. But what the book is basically the story of Geist, which is told in a very, I'm sure it was very thought out in the process, but the book itself has the feeling of something very spontaneous, kind of like great food. You know, great food sometimes. Jonathan Waxman years ago used to say that he wanted his food to look like it had just fallen out of the sky and landed on the plate. But of course, that wasn't an accident the way it looked on the plate. That was an effect. And this book, in very much in the way that, for me, the Manresa book found a unique way of telling that story, this book finds its own rhythm, its own visual style. It has watercolors in it. It has beautiful photography of the dishes. It has recipes, but then it has these sort of unexpected things like memos between Bo and his design team, little essays about aspects of restaurants that you probably haven't read, talked about in exactly the way Bo does it. He's got quite the gift for language. He talks about, in this interview even, a lot of things in a way that's very unique to him. And the book also has, and I don't want to give it away, but there is a transcript of part of the Rumble in the Jungle, which is the famous Muhammad Ali fight with George Foreman from the 70s. That's actually what we talk about at the beginning of the interview. So if you don't know that term, Rumble in the Jungle, that's what that was. And we do get into a little bit, but it was one of the great underdog victories in sports history, I would say. Anyway, that's all I want to say about this interview. I think you're going to love it. I had a great time. I'd never met Bo before, and I really, really, really enjoyed speaking with him. It was just great. I also want to say, going in, that there are some acoustical oddities on this episode. I don't know quite why. We interviewed at the PR firm Becca PR in their beautiful conference room. It was behind a door, and for some reason, we could hear in the background a little bit on the audio, some of the noise of the office, and even some ambient stuff like the microphone cords on the table. I don't know what it is about that space, the combination, I should say, of that space and my equipment, but for some reason, there's a little bit more background noise than usual. My apologies to Bo for that. I don't think it distracts from the interview, but just so you know, I'm aware it's there, and I'll try not to have that happen again, but there's no way to get it out. Because it occurs as we're talking in some places. So my apologies for that. And with that, I'm going to now turn it over to my interview with Chef Bo Beck, recorded earlier this week in New York City. Here you go. I'm going to start not with the beginning of the book, not with the beginning of your story. Can you please explain to me the place that Muhammad Ali holds in your life?
Rumble in the Jungle.
Yep.
It holds, you know, you have early childhood memories.
Sure.
And you, it's probably not even the earliest ones you can remember. It's just because your dad or your mom kept telling them over and over. And I remember my father waking me up to come into the living room to see the match. And then
this is before, not to see the aftermath of the victory, but to actually watch the match.
Yes.
Okay.
And what it means to me today is when we opened Geist, mm-hmm, back in 2011, mm-hmm, I came from a profession. I was grown up in, or brought up in, fine dining. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you know, when you do fine dining, there are so many pluses and minuses and views on what it is and what it should be and what it shouldn't be and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Very basically, I wanted to give the city a new classic with Geist.
Mm-hmm.
But I was going from a 10-seater restaurant to a 50-table restaurant, like a 100-seater restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was going large, big time.
Right.
It also felt a little bit intimidating because everyone was questioning it more on a moral level, because it felt like you were leaving some sort of Scientology club or something.
Or regressing. Or regressing, right? Because you were at what most people would consider the pinnacle, and you decided to...
That's your words. But I can live with it. But what I mean is it felt like it was a huge match that could go both ways.
Mm-hmm. So that's the analogy to the Foreman Ali fight.
And the reason why it's in the book, actually, is it's played at the restroom.
Yes.
When you...
The audio of the commentary. The
yes.
Of the commentary.
So I've actually heard him win probably 500 times or something, plus minus.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the why.
Right. The other thing, though, I think about that fight that's so fascinating, and for people who don't know, we're talking about a very famous fight. There's a movie called We Were Kings, which is a great documentary about this fight. Ali was going to fight George Foreman, who was, if you only know him in his older age, he was a terrifying figure. He went around with a junkyard dog. He was a very brutal boxer. Everyone thought Ali was going to lose, and this is where the term rope-a-dope comes from. Ali outsmarted him and won the fight in a very brilliant and beautiful way. So that's what we're talking about.
Exactly.
But this also, I think, speaks to just being intelligent, just thinking about a plan, making a plan. No?
Totally.
I mean, not to bring it down to so much down to earth, but or Ali, really break it down, yes, he was in physical
jeopardy, but he
had a plan.
Yeah, but... You have a plan, but I've never tried boxing. I've not even been in a fight in my real life or in my other lives. I think when, especially, let's say, for example, the analogy to a kitchen compared to a boxing ring, you have a plan or an idea of a plan until the rumble begins.
Yes. Well, that's the famous. Do you know the famous Mike Tyson line?
No, hit me.
Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
True. But apparently you like boxing.
I used to. Yeah. I don't feel like there's the sort of figures there used to be.
No.
When there were really great figures out there,
I
found it compelling. I like one-on-one sports.
Yeah.
I like one-on-one sports. So I'm going to just freestyle a little, if that's
okay. Hey, listen.
Okay. Because
Let's freestyle the rest of your book.
I know it's very thought out, but the book has a sort of what feels like a free-form style.
Yeah. It's done as a menu, as I cook.
That's interesting.
That's how it's...
I didn't think of it that way.
No, but that's how it's produced. So it's as... Apparently, I can see you've actually opened the book and read it.
Yeah, I loved it. I spent a lot of time with it. Yeah.
The book has been done purely out of for love of food and for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate secrets. And I believe it's a big word to say inspire, but I've been inspired by so many people. I've read so many books.
Mm-hmm.
And there comes a time in your life when you feel you need to pass on the torch.
Yeah.
Or you have to sort of make it official.
Yeah.
These are your views. These are your points. This is what you represent.
Yes.
Or I represent.
Right.
Geist.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about fighting a minute ago.
Yeah.
There's a very long, relatively long for this book, because you don't put headnotes on your recipes, the little introductions to recipes. You write introductory essays that precede what you call the five pillars, right, which are the five sections of recipes in the book.
Yeah.
And then you just have the recipes with these beautiful photographs.
Thank you.
But you do have other passages in the book. One of them is you describe service in in pugilistic terms as a fight. You actually use the term battle. Mm. You talk about dying. Somebody might die, but it needs to be a beautiful death. Can you just speak to this for a minute? I've never seen it described. I've heard people describe it as going into battle. Yeah. You know, feeling like, you know, right before service starts, you're all in the foxhole together, yeah, and you're about to storm. I've heard that, but yeah, you really take this analogy and run with it.
No, but it's actually the two last pieces of the puzzle of the book, mm-hmm, that came together, because there wasn't actually any a plan to have any words like that. And what we're talking about the show.
Right.
The chapter, The Show,
yes,
which explains 24 hours.
In the day of a restaurant.
In the day of a restaurant, mm-hmm, which actually begins after service, mm-hmm, where you almost have a debrief, a natural debrief, like we're having a conversation, mm-hmm, right now. And you have to understand, if you go to bed around 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. and you begin 10 a.m., and then you have to go home, come back to work, sleep, do what other things in life there exist, you end up getting actually tired. Mm. So there's a moment just before service where there needs to be a clap.
Right.
Sort of like, wake up.
Yeah.
Now it's game time. Now, yes, we've been surfing. I'm not saying we haven't been serious.
Yes.
Of course we have.
But you describe that in your prose.
No, but of course.
As in being in a fight and getting, it's good to be punched in the face early, right? Because it makes you realize you better get your act together.
No, but I think what I'm trying to explain,
yeah,
that a lot of people are afraid of touching base with reality of, mm, a kitchen. Mm-hmm. And the reality is a restaurant is like a train station.
Mm.
When the first train arrives, regardless of what happens, they arrive. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine me calling you and say, I'm sorry, we had an electricity breakdown. One of our chefs got married today, or I cut myself in the finger. Could you come tomorrow instead?
Right.
It's not. It's really like a theater.
Yeah.
And so the show really goes on. And I think that's the element we love. At Geist, I sort of, as in life, firmly believe that the truth is easier to remember than the lie. And by that, I mean no secrets. By that, I mean an open kitchen,
mm-hmm,
open, no shelves. Everyone can see each other. You're completely naked. And there's something beautiful about when you, as a chef, can actually see who you're cooking for.
Mm.
But there's also some beauty in the people that are eating,
yeah,
can see who is cooking for them.
Yeah.
There's a humility in it.
Mm-hmm.
It brings it to a certain eye height. But the thing is, eventually, as the train has arrived and the customers burst out,
right,
there'll be pressure points.
Yeah.
And when those pressure points are there, there can be a moment where you're under such a tremendous pressure that you are, in a way, getting slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
You're dying, not physically dying.
No, of course not.
But you're
of
under so not. Much. You have, yeah, so many balls in the air.
Yeah.
And there I have an expression called, you have to die beautiful.
Right. So it has to be a beautiful death.
So don't do the movements of you're stressed. Don't do the movements of you're under pressure when you talk to someone by pointing. Like, do the act.
Be with it.
Yeah. Be with it.
Yeah.
And perform.
It. Yeah.
The other thing is, eventually, if you're a successful restaurant,
yeah,
there will be that sort of melting point.
Mm.
Where, because otherwise you have too many employees. If, mm-hmm, you have too many employees, people get lazy.
Yeah.
And then they fall asleep. So there needs to be this balance of it. And I try to describe, how do you tackle when the shit hits the fan?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because you didn't pay attention at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, but then I gotta wake you up. And there are many ways you can do that. And that I'm explaining in the book. There's also the other one where you're just under so much pressure, but there's nothing you can do. Yeah. The system works. All the stations are doing what they do. Yeah, but then you just stick together as a team.
Yeah.
And you work your way through it.
Yeah. And it's also interesting that you do, you mentioned the title of that section is called The Show.
Yeah.
And you do make the point, to your, you just sort of referenced it in a way where you said that, you know, if you're dying, don't show that you're dying, right?
No.
That the guests are there to see the show. They're not there to see the battle.
No. True.
Right?
So true.
Yeah. Something else I found really interesting about the book, I feel like most books that are based around a restaurant, they take what's happened in the past. They do what reporters do. They take what's happened in the past and they make it very neat and clean, right? It can sometimes be almost boxy and dull, right? I read a book years ago called Zen and the Art of Screenwriting, and it came out at a time when there were all these screenwriting books that were coming out that really, some of them were very formulaic. You know, the peak moment in the script should happen on exactly the middle page of the script, you know? This book was, if you wake up with an idea, keep a notebook by your bed, just write down the idea. If you have a scene, write the scene. If you, and eventually, it might take years, but you'll have probably a screenplay. You'll have to do some work to make it nice and pretty, right? This, to me, this book, this free-flowing, I know it's very thought out.
But there
is a free-flowing nature. There are they watercolors?
Mm-hmm.
There's watercolor paintings throughout.
Mm-hmm.
There's prose dropped in sometimes as part of the mix.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are these five pillar recipe chapters. I didn't really explain how you work it in before, but there's actually the script or a transcript, I guess, of the Ali Foreman rumble in the jungle of the commentary comes later. And I almost feel like the feeling you get reading it is not that you're looking back at a process, but that you're actually experiencing what the process was like. You have memos between yourself and your designers talking about the name and the feel and all of that. Does that all make sense?
Totally.
Yeah. That, to me, was the experience of the book. I felt like I knew what it was like to be there in the ramp up to this restaurant.
Mm. In a way, it was almost like you could say the way I hear you describe it.
Yeah.
It's like a manual how to do a restaurant.
Yes, but in a way,
it's describing the process
right.
of what you're going through and what will occur to you.
Right,
pluses and minuses.
But
for me, going back when I said the book is done in the way, so the reason for the title In My Blood is in Danish, there's a word called hjerteblod. That means, loosely translated, heart blood. Hjerteblod in Danish means this is your child.
Mm.
This is your family members. This is the sum of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not in, we're jumping back and forth, and I guess that's okay. The other part I wrote is the conception.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because I think when with confidence and with experience and I guess coming with age,
mm-hmm.
you when you eat a lot, I hate all these little castles of dots and dips,
mm-hmm.
and herb. I like, in a way, you could almost go to the reference of the boxing. I like a straight hit or an intelligent approach. But I like them, when people cook, to be straightforward, to get to the point.
Well, you could also talk about honesty.
But I don't want... I don't need any security within it. So the food I do, I'm trying to put it on a pedestal and celebrate it and find its true nature in a way.
Yeah.
And the way I've realized that is that I have these five pillars you keep referring to, which, for example, can be rage.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a journey. I'm explaining it in the book, but it's where I'm traveling and someone greets me and takes me by the hand and shows me maple syrup And even though I've tasted maple syrup a million times, it's almost like they are ripping the curtain down and showing me for the first time. And there I get an understanding of what this is. So that's how the book is done. This is how Geist is created. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize this before I had to, because the chapters was one of the last things we did, because it was sort of like, how do we divide this book up? Do we do Vivaldi's four seasons, spring, autumn, yeah, blah? Do we do starters, main course, blah? Right. How do we do this?
Yeah.
And then I started writing on the conception of how I cook, and all of a sudden I realized it was a gift. And I think that happens to me a lot. If you're also patient and you wait a little bit, mm-hmm, for the answer, it will come.
Mm. Right. Yes.
I don't know if any of this made sense.
100%, but I think it goes back to how we started talking about this, because I was saying that there was this free-flowing quality of the book. Your response was, it's almost a manual for how to create a restaurant. And what I would say is that, yes, and that one of the lessons of it is that that's not going to be a totally linear process. Mm. You can't completely be on a time frame. You can't have a calendar that says... Mm. Have the name by this day, because you may not have had that moment of inspiration yet. Right?
True.
Okay. I'm going to get more linear.
No? You do what you do.
Okay. I don't usually go this way, but I don't know. It seemed like it would be a fun way to talk to you.
What was your immediate reaction when you got the book and you flipped through it the first time?
My immediate reaction was, my backstory is I've collaborated on more than 20 cookbooks with... I guess all American chefs.
Yeah.
When you said, how do we organize it? And then when you said, should we do courses, right? And I made a face. That's because that's 98% of cookbooks out there are probably organized that way.
Yeah.
So when something has life, when something has oxygen the way this does, I'm immediately, just on visuals alone, I'm intrigued, because I feel like it's going to be unique. It's going to be singular. And then when I got into this is the kind of book I love. I love books that have.
Thank you.
I love notebooks, and not just by chefs. Yeah. You know, I loved F. Scott Fitzgerald, the writer, and there was a book published called The Crack Up,
yeah,
and it had essays and it had his notebooks, and there in one part of it there's just A to Z, that the way he kept just sentences that he had written, or little fragments, descriptions of things. I can still quote some of them.
They never
got put into books.
No. You've probably been, if you've done 20 books, you've been to so many meetings and brainstorms. Yeah. There's a, what I've learned when you cook, when you have a team, I have about 70 employees or something,
mm-hmm,
at one restaurant at Geist. And that's not important. But what you learn when you talk to people is, if you also want to put them on a pedestal, even though regardless of what their position is.
Yes.
If you want to make them shine, you have to be able to swap between different levels and have different caps on. And when you talk, they all have different journeys in their life. They are on different, sequences? Or not sequences. Some of them are young, 22. Mm-hmm. Some of them are
different
38.
Timelines.
Yeah. That's the word. Yeah. I'm sorry for my lack of English. But the timelines...
You're doing much better in my language than I would do in yours.
They're on different timelines.
Yeah.
And the thing I realized is, in order of one of the many aspects of being a good leader also,
yes,
is I got to understand that even though I had my virginity,
mm-hmm,
and I lost it,
mm-hmm,
and I gained and I have knowledge, I have to let them experience their, not virginity, but the loss of it.
Yes.
And this, the stumbles and the burning, the blisters, all these things. And so I don't know, I've never said this in English. You know when you have a yes hat and a no hat?
Okay.
Do you have that expression?
No, but I know what you
so
mean.
So when you're doing a brainstorm,
yeah,
if you're creating a room where now we're letting our minds float free.
Yeah.
You gotta be able, regardless of whatever crazy idea a human being brings to the table.
Yeah.
Just let them go.
Mm-hmm.
Let them float. And that's how this book, that's how Geist is done. Then later on in the process,
yeah.
then we say, okay, stop. Now we've been in a spiritual moment in way too long now. Now we start to be concrete. What do we have? How do we proceed forward?
Mm-hmm.
How do we be more precise, concrete? How can we create opera?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at a dish, in a way, if you go to an established fine dining restaurant of a more historical perspective or classical views, you'll have one dish would have all the elements, something soft, something creamy, something crisp, mm-hmm. something braised, something raw, something, all these elements. And in a way, we've taken that one dish, that one component, that one picture, and stretched it like it is a harmonica or like a, when you know. So when I go soft, I'll choose to devote an entire dish by just being creamy and soft. Because that way I'm creating hills, mountains, waterfalls, and I eating can be very, how do you say, when it's tiring sometimes, even though it's fun, it's exhausting.
You can fatigue.
You can fatigue.
Yeah.
Because the amount of knowledge you're being presented with, it's like you're sitting down on the school bench again. Like it's, the wines, the food. So what I like is just to say, hey, but Geist is a restaurant that has 30 dishes a la carte. You know what you picked.
Yeah.
So when we present it, it's like turbot.
Right.
Langoustine.
Yes.
Carrots.
Yeah.
We don't go into depth. Then it's up to the customer to say, excuse me, what's happening here?
And that's fine with you.
Totally.
Yes.
You got to create that element.
Is it in the book, or is it, I read some interviews with you before getting ready to speak to you today. I know you have said before that you don't like being, you just sort of said it, you know, assaulted almost with information when you sit down in a restaurant.
No, but it hate me to say it, and probably a lot of people will disagree with me. The main purpose of going to a restaurant is that you're sitting around the table at a counter together with a friend or whatever social event is happening.
Right.
And you're there for that situation.
Right.
That's the main event.
Right.
And on top of that, you're so lucky that you're also going to enjoy a beautiful,
right.
well-created dish
yeah.
and a beautiful pour of wine
yeah.
or kombucha, whatever is yeah. In the glass.
Yeah.
You know?
It's very fun.
And if people are happy,
yeah.
and I'm not talking about, how naive, people can't always be happy, but if they're joyful. So, for example, on the back of the book, it says begeistert. And that's the only Danish words that's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And begeistert basically is translated into enthusiasm. So we wanted to make a slang, it's like an ism, out of we want you to arrive enthusiastic. Because we are also remembering ourselves to be enthusiastic. So we sort of, begeistert, we removed be and stret. So you have Geist in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the name, Geist.
That's great. It's funny, you also want people to be comfortable.
Of course.
Yeah. By that is you've spoken, I think you may have been speaking actually of your prior restaurant, if I'm not mistaken, that it sometimes would take certain diners a long time just to settle in and feel relaxed.
Yeah.
To feel comfortable in a dining situation of that caliber.
Yeah.
I remember, he's not there anymore, but a guy named Larry Nadeau, who used to be the general, the maitre d' of the French Laundry, saying to me that it was when people came there, they spent maybe the first half hour just trying to make them feel at home.
Yeah.
Because a lot of customers, it was like a pilgrimage they made.
Yeah.
And it was like they were visiting the White House. They were so nervous.
Yeah.
That's probably one of the worst ways you could have somebody be in your restaurant.
That's why having a few flaws makes it down to earth.
What do you mean by flaws?
Flaws. It can be you're playing a bit too loud music. It can be the waiters are down to earth wearing their own clothes. It can be there isn't... you guys are used to this in America, and especially in New York, brick and mortar country. But you're used to not having a tablecloth. There are certain elements you can work on. The thing about the tablecloth, besides, it actually makes the table much warmer for your arms to lean on. Yeah. It also cuts down the excessive noise. It's not only about fine dining. Right. So the way you tweak and twerk a restaurant is you're actually showing if you know the tools of how you can make people comfortable.
Right. Love it. Look, can we go through the five pillars? So these
Hit
are the,
me.
These are the way the recipes, and I should say, if you know, the credits in the back, you shot these dishes yourself.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
Before we get to the pillars, I have a question for you. If there's an aesthetic decision you made, because again, I've worked on so many cookbooks where there's a prop stylist and a food stylist and, you know, the whole team, right? Unless I'm mistaken, you use the same plate and the same sort of dark, almost charcoal toned backdrop for all the food shots.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Was that because you just wanted to keep the focus solely on what was going on within the
actually,
confines
of the plate? The answer to the question is, I shoot the pictures with natural light, so I need as much light as possible. So by the window, there's a counter with a black surface.
Okay.
By coincidence.
That's it.
But that's where the light is best. Yeah. And some of the where it's more concrete is because at that window there isn't that table. There's another table, but I didn't. The that was a wood table, and I thought it was too light, so it made it pale. So I put the plates on the concrete floor. It's very. I don't walk the. I go straight at it. I don't need to go the furthest, the longest way to Rome.
No, this again goes to your thing about your boxing analogy, to your analogy of honesty, to your, it's interesting.
Yeah. The thing is also, when, in a way, no, I'm going to flip it. About 7 years ago, so Geist has been open for 7.5 years now, so... Right before I closed my former restaurant, because I got the opportunity to do Geist, I had a year off while we were building Geist, and I traveled. And a very clever woman saw that I was on Instagram. I just opened an account, and she said, "Listen, how are you shooting these pictures?" I said, "On my phone." She said, "You're going to regret if you don't buy a camera."
And this was a stranger who just messaged
a dear friend.
Okay.
A dear friend.
Okay.
And I took her advice because when women speak, you have to listen.
Okay.
Especially in those kind of cases. And I bought a camera. It started with a very small one. I decided to go for a Leica because I'm a design buff. And I liked something clean, simple, that was powerful. So I bought the smallest one.
Yeah.
And I started working with it. It changed my way of approaching. I started shooting pictures of the things we were doing in the kitchen. All of a sudden, without knowing, this is retrospectively, I can talk about this.
Yeah.
Because I was just fluid about it. I start looking at Geist, at us, the team, at our food from outside into
You almost became like a documentarian.
In a way.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the way I cook, I also thought, what could be the best possible way to showcase the food? And it's not with... these rock and roll photos of shadows and blur and straight up.
Yeah.
And the process was like doing, I actually always tried and remembered myself to, I want to take a picture of the plate And then there just happens to be something on the plate.
If I were going to broadly describe these five categories you have, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would describe the way you titled them in these essays that precede groups of recipes, I would broadly describe it as sort of the inspiration for these dishes, or
true,
the mindset yeah. the dishes came from.
Let me hear you say the pillars.
The pillars.
Yeah, the pillars.
Oh, list them?
Yeah, the five.
Okay, it's the rage, the journey,
introduction.
Sorry, I know them. The tribute.
Yeah.
And the reunion.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to explain what each of those are. Interestingly, you start with the rage. Well, that's very provocative, the rage. You have,
why is that provocative?
Because I think that's an unusual emotion to have a chef at least admit to having about certain ingredients. No?
Listen. Rage, when you're brought up in Scandinavia, in yeah. Denmark, in yes. Copenhagen,
yes.
since you can remember getting things stuffed in your mouth, every social occasion you've been to with yeah. family, whatever,
yes.
there'll be a starter dish,
yeah.
how to fuck up salmon, how to ruin salmon.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know this.
Right.
And it's the equivalent of some people have memories of their parents cooking liver a bit too much, so it becomes like leather.
Yes.
Rock hard. So in a way, something that's totally terroir, totally within your region.
Yeah.
It's the best physical product I can get.
Yeah.
I hate.
Mm-hmm.
Also because I began my journey as a chef, as an apprentice at a fish restaurant. I was so tired of it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find a way to make it shine.
Mm.
Bring out the nature I wanted it to have. And that's not an altercation of what it is. It's just how I think it should be. You could almost say the correct dress for the correct woman.
Mm-hmm.
and why am I saying this? I'm saying this because then you have an ongoing battle. 5 years, 10 years, 10 months,
mm-hmm.
depending on the ingredients and or the produce. And then all of a sudden, one day, you have a breakthrough.
Yeah.
And then you decide to put it back on the menu. That's rage. My view, my taste buds' views on endives.
Yeah. Do you not like bitter?
I don't. I'm not good with bitters.
Yeah. That seems to come up a lot. A lot of things you point to not really liking are bitter.
But now, as I'm getting older.
Yeah.
I'm starting to
change. You've acquired
change.
A taste?
Yes.
Okay.
So I guess it's coming with age. Yeah. But the thing about the bitterness is there's a, you want to understand it.
Yeah.
So when my chapter of rage is presented with 20 dishes, because mm-hmm. there's 100 dishes in the book, the 100 best dishes from Geist over the last 7.5 years.
Yeah.
Edited down actually from 249 that I've documented. And then it's they're split into 5 chapters, and so there's 20 in each of the 5 chapters.
Right.
But how could you say it's? I love rage.
Well, this is what my question was going to be.
I love it.
But here's my question, because I want to understand this. There are chefs I know who. I've heard you say in other interviews.
I could say I could have said struggle.
Yeah, no, I understand. Yeah.
Good.
I don't have a problem with it.
No.
But my.
You're so easy to talk to.
Are you being sarcastic?
No.
Thank you. When I said I thought it was provocative, that was a compliment. I think that's a good provocation. I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
and a shrewd thing, but what strikes me is you've said in other interviews, like, there were certain ingredients out there. I've heard you say it about chicories, again, and something else that's bitter. Yeah. You just don't get them, right? I've heard you say that.
Beef tenderloin.
Right. I don't get that.
No.
So there are chefs I know that would be the end of it. They would just let it, there's so much out there, right?
Yeah.
But you, when you say struggle, you know, to me, I look at these dishes and they almost feel like arranged marriages to me, you know, like you're looking to find a way to love this thing, you know, that you've been forced to be with, but you're the chef, it's your place, right?
Yeah.
You've chosen that challenge for yourself.
No, but let's look
Does
at...
Does that question make sense?
No and yes.
Okay.
But when you do a restaurant, when you do a menu...
Yeah.
Let me begin in a different way. When you do a restaurant, I try to look at the restaurant in the case of, where will I seat a business table? Where would be a good situation for them to sit? Where would be a good situation for an older couple to sit? Where would be a good situation for a date?
Yeah.
So I create these different scenarios. The more different countries I can have within the restaurant, the bigger a possibility of different groups of people will use my restaurant.
Yeah.
The same thing I do with the food. So I need to have a dish, if we continue with the chapter rage. If I want to do a steak, I'm not comfortable about having a cut de boeuf, even though I've eaten quite a few. So I thought, beef tenderloin. I need to have a proper piece of meat for the generation that loves red meat, roasted well, and after it's been grilled, we've charred some eggplants and then smeared it on top of the beef so it looks completely black and it gives this toasted element and smoky elements and also bitter elements, actually. Mm-hmm. And then beets, because I don't know why I'm such a fan of things working well together in terms of colors. And then a vinaigrette of sherry vinegar with peanut oil. So it's very simple and straightforward and direct. That's a dish for a person that's entered a restaurant by coincidence. They have no idea where they came in. Mm-hmm. It's a walk-in.
Or somebody brought them.
Or someone brought them as a party, and they're there.
Yeah.
They are not comfortable about having raw langoustines with yuzu cream and hibiscus. They don't want to eat. I could go on and on and on. But maybe they're not in the mood to being so challenged.
Yeah.
So why not have a proper dish for them also? I don't know if it makes sense.
100%. This is the thing. I know a lot of chefs who one of the biggest insults they will say behind another chef's back is they will say that person only cooks for themselves.
No, but you, when you, let's be honest, a restaurant at the end of the day is a business.
Yeah.
And I am responsible for 70 souls.
Mm-hmm.
That they have a job. That they work 3 days, work 3 days off. I'm responsible for their health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also responsible of nurturing and pushing them and making them shine and grow and move on other places. Their success will be my success.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes with the restaurant and the customers or the guests or the friends that visit us. It's the same thing. When you come to a restaurant, and I hope this is heard very positive, but there will be the ones that come in. They trust you so much, they'll just go for the things that sound odd,
right?
Because they believe you can pull it off.
Yeah.
The same situation. There'll be people arriving as judges. Don't really, they need to try it, but they'll like, I need to see this. It cannot possibly be good. Then you have people that come in, oh, I'm just in the mood for spinach stewed with Gruyere and salicon and patrons and bronze fennel.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that sounds nice. That's what I'm having.
Yeah.
Then you'll have people that come in. I know you have so many dishes on the menu, and I know I always eat the turbot because that's what I love. Now I'm coming because I want to try something different. But, you know, I think I'll try the turbot again.
Right.
So you have so many different scenarios.
Right.
And as chefs, we're used to that.
Yeah.
In our profession. There will be customers that will say, do you know what? The fennel or cheese for a fish dish doesn't really work.
Yeah.
Then you'll have other people coming in saying, oh my God, the cheese with the fennel for the fish, that's genius.
Right.
And they have no idea, out of reference, there's a lemon sole Florentine, which is his Escoffier classic. You live and you learn.
I love it. Okay.
We're just there to please people.
Yes, that's but what
with,
I meant before.
But within within that narrative,
yes.
By all means, I want to be me.
Yes. So this is you finding a way to be you,
yes.
With these things that you don't inherently understand.
Bingo.
Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enamel cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Not only because I use it constantly, but because cabinet space is at a premium in New York City kitchens. My boyfriend and I were gifted our Le Creuset by his family last Christmas, and it was the first piece of enameled cookware we'd ever owned. I'd been fawning over the marine blue color, especially when I realized there were only a few left in stock. When we unwrapped the box, we were pleasantly surprised to see how big this thing was. I immediately started imagining what I could cook. Roast chicken, Texas-style chili, a leg of lamb, or my favorite, a huge batch of Marcella Hazan's bolognese. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET.com/HRN, to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Welcome back to the show. I will return you in just a moment to the rest of the interview with Chef Bo Beck. I do want to remind you, if you'd like to follow the show, you can do that on Instagram. The handle is @ChefPodcast. That's @ChefPodcast. And if you would like to subscribe, which is free, you can do that on Stitcher and iTunes. You can also listen to the show on Spotify. If you're on Spotify a lot of the time, the show is available there. And I haven't mentioned this in a little bit, but I would really love, if you want to do something nice for the show during the holidays, please leave a rating or review at iTunes. It helps people find the show. And if you would like to recommend the show to people you think might enjoy it, I would love if you took a moment to do that, whether it's a tweet, an Instagram post, an email, a text. I would really love that. The show does seem to be gathering quite the audience, and I'd love to keep that going. So if you want to do something nice for the show for the holidays, that'd be a nice gesture that I would really appreciate. And with that, I'm going to now return you to my interview with Chef Bo Beck. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
Until a month before this book got sent to the printers, I had no idea I had these pillars.
Really? So you had selected the recipes, or most of them.
It was just a pile of dishes.
You were looking for an organizing principle.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. The tribute. You say here, what you open with, these are the easiest dishes to make.
Flip it into physicality.
Yeah.
You're looking at something. You simply just, everything in your entire body craves it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pro, it's a plus, plus, plus. Mm-hmm. You're in love, love, love. That's super easy.
Yeah. Okay. So some of these dishes, we're going to say grilled squid with black trumpet mushrooms, poached apple with rich creme fraiche and rosehip flowers. I love this. Green asparagus with sorrel and jalapeno. I have a thing about jalapeno with greens. It's a, I thought it was just me. I feel
but the way,
so
for example, let me explain the green asparagus.
Yeah.
So we get rather huge ones, locally sourced. And, oh my God, I just hate I said locally sourced. It's so done.
Oh, you hate that you just said it in this interview? Do you want me to edit it out?
No, by no means.
Just don't say farm to table and we'll get along fine.
But we halve them and then after they've been cleaned, washed, blah, 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 all these things.
Sure.
We put them with the skin side, the cutting side up, the skin side down in a dry pan. That is so hot that if you're even close to it, you'll get a burn. And then we take, when they get a slight like black roast, but it's going to be a very thin line on the skin, we cover them with sorrel leaves, huge sorrel leaves. And then we've, before this, we've grilled whole cucumbers that we then juiced. So we take that liquid, once the sorrel leaves are on top of the green asparagus, then we use the sorrel leaves as a lid. So we then pour over the cucumber juice.
Mm-hmm.
Then the steam will cook the asparagus. So you have the element of grilled chard. The one thing most chefs will know about sorrel leaves, it's a very delicate leaf. It's very... most people are afraid of it going army color. I don't know what you say in America, but you know when you have this bright green,
mm-hmm.
and then when it gets cooked, it goes into this pale,
yeah.
Dull green color, but
almost brown.
Yes, yeah. but greenish.
Yeah.
But see, those are for me secret messages to me that the sorrel leaf wants to look like this. So I'll, instead of making it my enemy and trying to avoid it, I'll go with it rather than go against it. So I'll then pour over the cucumber juice and then it'll evaporate super fast and steam. Then the leaves will sort of melt like cheese on top of the asparagus. We lift it up and then we dust it with jalapeno. It's so clean, so simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with artichokes. Do you know artichokes? You don't want them to color, so you turn them, you peel them, you do all the stuff. And some people put them in water with C vitamin. Some put them in white wine. Mm-hmm. Some put them with lemon juice and stuff like that. My approach is, if I want to go brown, then let's go with that. Let it go brown. Why? When I cook and when we cook at Geist, I always tell my chefs, the most important thing you have to remember, you don't want to lose flavor. You don't want to lose flavor. You don't want to dilute it. You don't want to throw it away. If you can just keep the flavor, you won.
So that citric element that everyone adds to artichoke to you is a distraction.
Totally.
Unless it's an intentional part
because,
of a dish.
Try and peel a carrot.
Yeah.
Put it in water. Leave it there for half an hour. Then taste the water. It'll taste of carrot.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the flavor from the carrot has gone into the water.
Right.
So you diluted it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you say diluted?
Yeah.
Yeah. You diluted it. So what you did is the most dishonest thing. You removed its identity. You altered it in a negative way. I'm very pro of altering it in a positive way.
Right. Interesting. It's funny to me. You seem, in the little, you have this little questionnaire in the front of the book that you answer. I assume it's your handwriting.
Yeah.
You describe yourself as stubborn.
Totally.
But in this way, you seem to be very fatalistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it early in your cooking career that you came around to this philosophy of letting something be what it wants? When did you have that epiphany?
It actually didn't begin before I opened Geist.
Not till then.
No. It didn't begin before.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So the introduction, this I relate to very personally, because there's one thing when I go to restaurants and they say, are you allergic to anything? And I always say, I'm allergic to almonds, which is true. And I always say, and I will not eat a raw oyster. So the introduction is you want to introduce people to things maybe they would be inclined not to eat. And the example you give, go ahead, correct me.
Not inclined not to eat. An introduction is very close to the same narrative as journey.
Okay.
Introduction is me admitting that I know this is tough love.
Mm.
Sweetbreads.
For some people, yeah.
No, but you're not born and raised, and then you have your first sweetbread, and then you're like, I'm in love. This is like meatloaf.
Right.
No, you're not.
Right.
You're not like when you have an oyster.
Right.
So there are food elements that I call tough love, where you need someone to teach you how to enjoy this. Mm-hmm. But once you got over that hurdle, that hill, oof, you'll never go back.
You know what I connect this to? With the way you explain it?
Yeah.
I think this is the sister chapter to the rage.
Yeah. There you go.
This is the diner's rage.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
There you go.
And you're the...
I never thought about that, but it's very
true. And
you're
the person who finally makes them understand it the way somebody finally makes you understand chicory.
For me, introduction is... and it's very cleverly seen. And I never thought about that. Well done.
Thank you.
But the thing for me, introduction is, and I can give you an example of how screwed up it can be sometimes. Let's take an oyster. In reality, the real challenging element is this blobby thing that you have to put in your mouth.
Yeah.
It's about consistency. Not consistency, the...
texture.
The texture, yeah. Sorry.
That's what I don't like about it.
It's the texture.
Yeah.
So what I would always do is, I would tell someone, take your finger, dip it into the water, put it in your mouth, tell me what it tastes like. Then they'll, it's salted water. I said, this is how this entire oyster tastes like. Then, so now, you know... The rest is only you're being challenged by the texture.
Mm.
It changes the game completely. But, for example, in the book, we had a daikon that we simply sliced like spaghetti, raw, and then we did a mayonnaise, but without eggs. So if you take oysters, you chunk them, and then you blend them, of course, without the shells, and then you add oil.
Mm-hmm.
It has sufficiency to bind the oil, so you have a mayonnaise, but without any eggs or anything.
Yeah.
So if you then think about one of my favorite pasta dishes is cacio pepe.
Mm-hmm.
It's all where you're testing the ability, how much cheese can melt around the spaghetti. How can you get this stretched? So I know... by definition, that people love that creamy texture. So we took the raw daikons, like spaghetti, and we mixed them around the oyster mayonnaise. The liquid softens them a little bit. And the funny thing is there's a bitter element to daikon, and salt reduces bitterness. So there the oyster is helping that. But by removing the texture, all of a sudden I have a beautiful, almost vegetable dish, but it's not a vegetable dish. It's a daikon with oysters.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the challenge. Then you put it on the menu. And it's almost like an homage, a tribute, an introduction to people who have difficulties about oysters. You should try this one. But the people that choose the dish often will get disappointed because they want six chopped oysters, chunked oysters on ice. Mm-hmm. That's what they're envisioning coming. So that they're your battles sometimes. Does it make sense at all?
100%.
But then you got to stick with your ideas and what is it you want to do. And
yeah.
It's not a 100-meter dash. It's sure. a marathon.
Right. Yes.
It's a marathon.
Yeah. Okay. The reunion are dishes that are references to something classic.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
It's a ripoff of a classic.
What?
Reinterpreted.
What some people, the filmmaker, would call an homage.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you have, well, this one, this is the dish you talk about a lot. You've mentioned it in this interview, turbo with fennel ravioli and Gruyere.
Yeah.
The cheese is actually takes the place of the pasta
yeah.
in this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, this is a very special dish because it's also an homage to a human being.
Mm-hmm.
It's an, a dish that's created for a Danish architect
yep.
called Jan Utzon. So it resembles the way it's plated, Sydney Opera House.
Right. So then we go on passion fruit tart, herb salad. What is this? Is this a riff on the usual accompaniments to bone marrow? Is that what this was meant as?
You can in a way, you have a whole bone marrow, halved,
yes.
grilled with chopped parsley.
That's what I mean. Yeah. That's what this is a...
But it's also a riff on a salad.
Okay.
But yeah. where you use... It's too bitter.
Right.
So you need to stop, hold the horses back. And there you use the bone marrow as the fatty element.
Okay. I need to ask you... We're almost out of time here, but I need to ask you... You know... I was looking through the book, the watercolors throughout.
Done by All the Way to Paris?
Yes. Now, so who is All the Way to Paris? Because as I was going through the book, I thought, these watercolors, for a restaurant that's in Copenhagen, these watercolors put me in mind of Paris. And then I get to the last page of the book where the credits are, and the artwork is by All the Way to Paris.
Yeah. But as in the beginning, there are some drawings.
Yeah.
Those are the mood board drawings when the architects based Copenhagen.
Yeah, yeah.
They wanted to show me their thoughts when we were in our process of creating Geist.
Yeah.
Then they suggested it because I needed to do websites and yeah. have a graphic identity. And they pointed me in the direction of All the Way to Paris.
Okay.
So I've been working with them for 8 years.
Okay.
And in this book, the way we use the watercolors is also to try and soften it up a bit.
It's a surprise.
And have this element of romance.
Yes.
And it's most often it's pictures I've taken that they basically do into a watercolor.
Is that right? So they,
yeah.
Okay, so they did sort of their approximation of something.
Some of the pictures, some of the other pictures are totally out of the blue, a state of mind. We
yeah.
need, like there's probably 40 watercolors that's not in the book, sadly.
Mm.
But we wanted normally I don't say I, but when you do a book, you need to learn to say I.
Well, especially if you, wait, let me get the credit. If you're the editor, writer, recipe, and photography, that's all you.
But the thing is, we wanted to try, how do you get the vibe, the energy of a restaurant?
Mm.
How do you transport that in to a book?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to take pictures of people.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, the answer was very clear, and it was their idea. Why don't we do watercolors?
Yeah.
And again, when women speak, you listen.
Well, the other thing I love, and you do talk, I've seen you talk about this in other interviews, right? The male-female balance, right?
Yeah.
And it actually reminded me, I once had a conversation with Alice Waters at Chez Panisse, who told me that that restaurant has always functioned best when there's an almost equal mix of men and women in the restaurant. But what I was going to say was, you know what it reminds me of, and I hope you'll take it as a compliment. I know you worked for him at one point in your life. Marco Pierre White,
mm-hmm.
One of the most brilliant juxtapositions to me was that book White Heat where you have those almost dungeon like medieval black and white photographs of the kitchen of the people in the kitchen, which revolutionary at the time, and then the full color photographs of the beautiful dishes on the Villeroy and Bosch basket weave plates, right? That's an amazing contrast, right? And to me, in this book, you have you know, your essay, for example, about the battle, right? But the watercolors that precede it and come after it are very tranquil. It's somebody standing by the bar enjoying a drink. It's the show.
But do you also
versus the battle?
It's the best compliment you could give me ever. And you know what? I was working in 95 in London. I was working at a restaurant called Gavroche.
Sure.
And I had no idea the historical perspective of this very significant restaurant.
Yeah.
And I went to a bookshop called Books for Cooks.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw two books that I took about 12 books down from the shelves and glanced at them. And then I bought two books and they shocked my world. Shocked my world. And until that moment, because I was a late bloomer, I didn't start cooking before the age of 24.
This is the last question I was going to ask you.
So the two books, one was a purple cover with a T on the front, and it was by Charlie Trotter.
Mm.
I'd never seen food like that in my entire life.
Was it the first one?
The first one.
Yeah.
And the other one was White Heat.
Mm.
White Heat has probably standed the test of time a bit better than Charlie Trotter's book, but you can't. That's the beauty of a book, and maybe also why I feared it so much to do it. Because you know, when you're a chef, you live in a very fluid world where the proofs get eaten.
Yeah.
So you're not held accountable in the same way. So you are very quick-tongued and witty and sharp like a ninja, but or a samurai, but you're never actually held accountable in the reference of history.
Mm.
But when you do a book, all of a sudden, you're putting a mark, in a way, on it. Because all of a sudden, you can't alter this. You can't. I can't tomorrow. I mean, when I got the book from the printer, it took me a month before I sat down and actually went through it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a year and a half ago, I did my first book, What Does Memory Taste Like?
Yeah.
And I remember I opened it up. I went to the bathroom the second I got it at the restaurant. It was the only place that was quiet. And I flipped through it. I sat there for an hour and a half. And my world broke down when I left the room. I found 9 mistakes.
Mm.
And I was like, how on earth did I miss those? Because I've looked through that book so many times, you have no idea. So I feared opening this book.
Mm.
But luckily, I haven't, and this is not an encouragement for people to find. And then
this is not a game.
No.
If you find any, keep it to yourself.
but not at all. But you know, and it's also just a manual for the people working at the restaurant. It's, hey, this is what we are about.
A couple of things about what you just said.
Yeah.
One is about the book and about the manual. And when you say for people who work, I think one of the most challenging things for a chef who operates at the level that you operate at is this has almost become a theme in this season, right? I just had a conversation, I'm editing the episode right now with Magnus Nilsson about this exact thing. Conveying what's in your head to the people who are cooking in your restaurant is one of the hardest things, I think. You can correct me if it's not true for you. But I think this, you know, when you asked me my reaction before, I thought this is going to be a book that really explains to me who this guy is and what this restaurant is in a non-cookie-cutter way.
Mm.
Right.
That's the biggest compliment that's you what can
I
give me,
and that's what I feel like it is. I hope it's apparent the way I'm talking about it. Can I quickly ask you, 24 years old, you was when you first contemplated this career.
Yeah.
How is that even sitting here talking to you and having seen you before sitting here talking to you in interviews and reading about you and was it Were you happy before that? You seem so in your element. You seem so comfortable in your skin. You seem so assured of your opinions and your thoughts. I can't imagine. And did you work at General Motors? Am I correct about that?
Correct.
Yeah. This is like when I heard Elvis Costello was a computer programmer till he was 21. I mean, how did that happen?
He's actually a really nice guy, by the way.
Yeah.
I can tell you how it happened, and you already know how it happened, and maybe the people that listen don't know how it happened, but I can tell you how it happened. I have this line, I've always said, how can you miss something if you don't know it exists? Mm. And I think the reason why I'm saying, how can you miss something if you don't know it exists? Because you can't. And I was brought up in a very loving family with a mother and father. I couldn't have dreamt a better scenario. Mm-hmm. There were a few times when I asked them, why didn't you give me a bigger brother or a smaller brother or a sister? But that's a different thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm a lone child. But I thought you went to work to obtain a paycheck to then have fun. I had no idea that going to work could be fun. Mm-hmm. There was no one in my circle, my sphere, that went to work and had fun.
Right.
Zero.
You went to work to make a living, to pay for food, to pay for your home, and that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. But so when I stumbled almost into the pot, it was such a thunder trusting. Did you say thunder trusting? No, like a thunder,
like a thunderbolt.
Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
Reaction to me.
Yeah.
It was. I know it sounds so corny, and I know the word love is so overexposed, overused, manipulated, but it was like being kissed for the first time. And then when you hit this thing, then you crave it. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember myself as being popular in school. I wasn't the quarterback. Mm-hmm. I wasn't the clever kid. I was plain, simple, average, dull, fat, all those things. I wasn't a success as I remember myself. But when I entered a kitchen at the age of 24, just coming out of the army also, after 2 years, I was trained perfectly to arrive that moment. Because when a chef looked at me and said, jump, I wouldn't say why.
Right.
I would say, how high?
Yeah.
If they gave me an order,
yeah,
it was an order.
Call and response.
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
So, and then on top of that, if you are in your element of you're finding what you are naturally good at,
yeah,
then you want to kick the ball down the mountain. Because people made fun of me and sort of teased me and said, like, my head chef was 24 years old and I was 24. They like mocked me and sort of like, why do you even want to take this as your education?
No, it takes a special courage to go into the kitchen in your 20s.
You're gonna be retired before you are educated. Why on earth do you want to waste your time on this? And that encouraged me to push the pedal down and sort of go as fast as physically possible, and trying to see if I could fall. But I didn't.
Yeah.
Of course I did, but
you got not in a fatal way.
No, and you know what I also love about the physicality about cooking is if you're present, if you have the ability to be right there, right now, and you shut out all the other things, you basically just have to watch and copy what someone else teaches you,
yeah.
And then The rest is about getting that mechanism worked into your body movements.
Muscle memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. We need to stop. This was great.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for
this book.
It was
truly a pleasure. No.
The book is, I'm just going to say one more time, In My Blood by Bo Beck. I loved it. It made me want to read your prior book, What Memory Tastes Like.
And can I, sorry, interrupt and say a quick way to buy it.
Yes.
You go onto my website.
Go ahead.
Chef Bo Beck,
yeah.
BOBECH.com.
Yep.
You'll have it within 5 days.
Beautiful. Thanks for your time.
Lovely.
And that's our show for this week. Vitor, thank you for doing double duty this season, as always, and editing this show on a Saturday. Matt, Katie, Kat at Heritage, thanks for all your extra help this season. Thanks again to Chef Bo Beck. And a reminder, if you want to order that book, chefbobeck.com is the place to do that. And until next time, thank you, all of you out in podcast land, for listening, and we will see you back here in a few days on Andrew Talks to Chefs.